Hello and welcome to Studio Sessions, the big red and shiny podcast where we talk with artists about the ideas, inspiration, and processes that go into their work. I'm your host Matt Kuhlman, and my guest this episode is Rob Andrews. Rob is a performance artist whose pieces often deal with ritualistic practices. These can sometimes be rituals that he creates himself, and sometimes rituals borrowed directly from existing practices. Transformation through ritual is a centerpiece for many of his works, and frequently becomes a test of people and humanity through their reaction to them. Join me as I talk to Rob about the wealth of interconnected ideas that inform these pieces.
Wonderful, thank you, Matt.
Good to meet you here.
Yeah.
As we were just talking about before we started recording this interview, I just saw your work recently, like a couple weeks ago up in Boston.
Yeah.
At the Time Body Object Space performance, which was, you were given an hour out, along with 11 other people, and did a performance that I got to see. And at the time, I didn't know that we had already arranged this interview, but I didn't know that you were the person that was going to be coming down the
Even
stand.
Better, right?
I realized it when I was preparing for this trip to come down here. I was like, oh, I just saw this guy.
Oh, that's great, man. So,
but we can start with that piece since I've actually seen it live.
Sure.
From what I remember, you kind of set up a ring, kind of like an altar of some kind, in the mm-hmm. middle with like a coyote pelt, a couple statuettes, and you were wearing, was it a Reagan mask? I can't.
It was a Reagan mask. Okay. Yeah, I have it on the porch. Yeah. We can get it later.
It had some paint on it, so it was like, oh, it could mm-hmm. be George Bush, but I think it's Reagan.
Yeah.
And you were wearing
But you knew it was a Republican.
Yeah. Yeah. Nobody wore a Democrat mask. Jimmy Carter, he's not scared.
That's right.
But so you were wearing that in a kind of dirty suit, and you had, when you took the mask off, eventually you had like black face paint on, and you were, spent a lot of the time like dancing around mm-hmm. really wildly. You handed people out radios that were all playing the same thing. There was some LP in there, I remember.
Yeah. Oh, you're a hip-hop guy.
Oh, yeah.
Totally. Oh, yeah.
And
Cannibal Ox.
There was some Cannibal Ox in there, too. I think I wrote those down.
Yeah.
So, what was happening in this? Describe start to finish, like, what your intentions were and, like, how you were acting your ideas out, I suppose. And
sure. Yeah. Okay. So, it's like, so I'll probably take a step back and say, like, this is partially about, I have to talk about process in order to talk about that piece in particular.
Mm-hmm.
Like, almost all of my recent work has been about transfiguration, right? Or the act of sort of, like, ritualizing transformation and becoming something else, and in so doing, then becoming like the bridge for the audience to also become that thing or recognize that thing inside themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So there's like larger structures within my work that can describe that. We can talk about those later, but
mm-hmm.
Like one of the narratives, like one of the cultural narratives that I've been interested in and working on is this idea of vampires. And then there's like, vampires are having a sort of a cultural moment themselves anyway.
Yeah.
Right? Like Twilight and all that shit, but
yeah, they got their own universe. It's
Yeah. But like for me, I became interested in vampires through the idea of time. I have a collaborator named Rishika Marishi, who, and only weeks before I did another performance called Vampire Song.
Okay.
And she and I essentially performed as some version of vampires, right? And I became mm-hmm. interested in the idea that if your life on some level wasn't mediated by fear of death and there was no time, like, what are you then?
Mm-hmm.
Like, how do you measure yourself? Like, what's your fucking yardstick? Like, how do you...
What do you got to look forward to?
Right, I mean, so, like, are you just, like, nauseatingly boring? Like, there are no existential crises. There's no growth. There's no death. There's nothing. So that, to me, seemed like an interesting door to walk through, right? So that piece in particular was, I wanted to become that vampire for everyone.
Okay.
Right, so another sort of through line through my work is, and I always feel like sort of self-conscious talking this way, but, you know, like, my influences are, like, Joseph Beuys on one hand, and I one of my mentors, this guy named William Popel, who's sort of one of those, like, dominant, like, narrative storyteller, like, artist as shaman on some level. And I feel really self-conscious.
And that's kind of what Boys was about, too. Like, he was kind of a shamanistic character in some instances.
Yeah, and there's, like, there's so many narratives and tropes built into that. Like, the artist as trickster, the artist as interpreter, the artist as cultural, not creator, but the artist as, like, sort of, or the shaman as, like, the structure whereby you enter a story.
Okay.
Right? Mm-hmm. And, so that piece for me was about, like, how do I become this horrible thing, right? And my work historically has, like, I always seem to bring out the worst in people.
Yeah.
You know, like, I've been beaten, kicked, spit on. I put myself in these situations where, like, I become this heinous thing, but also at the same time I'm, like, extremely vulnerable. So it was a ritual. It was a way to become a vampire. And a lot of the dancing that I did was sort of modeled very, very loosely on African dance rituals, death rituals.
Okay.
Sort of this, like, it's a way to pass from not void to void, right? And I'm interested in the idea of void.
Okay.
Anti-meaning.
I did note that you didn't take the mask off until you entered that ring that you had in the room,
right,
finally. So while you're dancing around, you always had the mask on. But when you transformed,
right,
was right when you entered the ring. So.
And I think it was terrible. It was terrible for me on some level. It was actually the first time in a long time I've been, I wouldn't say nervous is the right word, but, like, I knew that I was going to go to this place. Like, this, I was going to become this thing.
So you really felt, like, psychologically transformed.
I was
when you're
fucked. I was totally. I mean, and I did things that I actually, on some level, now in retrospect, I'm not ashamed of them. But like, in my practice, in all of my practices, like, as a teacher, as a father, as an artist, like, if I can become the authentic thing, there's like a price to be paid for that.
Yeah.
You know, like, you sort of, you slough off, like, a little piece of yourself.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I'm like, I did, like, these incredibly sexually aggressive things,
yeah,
as the vampire. Because...
Yeah, you acted kind of, like, possessed in a way, and
And I fucking felt that way, and I understand, like, how hokey it is, and on some level, maybe I have to say that I became the thing in order for the narrative to be true, you know what I mean? And that's, like, the trickster, right? And I just fucked it up.
That's out of the bag.
Right, yeah, yeah, but, like, and as an artist, anyway, like, even talking about, the way we view art and the way we view storytelling. And I just said this last night to a couple of my collaborators, you know, like, I think the artist's responsibility is to create, like, a double blind situation. So you create an artifice, and you acknowledge by creating it that it is an artifice. So people are like, okay, I know what I'm getting myself into.
Yeah.
Right? Okay, this guy's wearing a Reagan mask and he's dancing around. Okay, I think I get it, you know. And then you tell the real story, which is that on some level, like, ritual can sometimes, if performed correctly, yield, like, threatening chaos.
Uh-huh.
Like, the shit that keeps you up at night.
Yeah.
Like, that's what I'm interested in. And it's only actually, it's amazing that we're talking, because it's only really in the last, like, 6 months that I've sort of accepted that role. Like, as an artist and a storyteller, like, because it's more complicated than being avant-garde or something like that. Like, I realize that, like, I'm a particular kind of storyteller, and that the storytelling that I'm doing is about fear, and it's about accepting void and exploring it, and allowing other people to explore it through me, however much it takes for me.
Yeah.
You know, and I think I don't want to sound like a martyr because I don't feel like a martyr, but like the vector of my life has led me to like this place of like service on some level. Like I'm a public school teacher. I get chairs thrown at me and kids tell me to go fuck myself, you know, every day, you know, and like and also in my artwork.
You become a vampire in that instance and you're like, this is no kid.
Yeah, that's just, but no, but you know, like I have like, you know, like 18-year-old boys like get in my face and tell me they're gonna fucking kill me, you know? Yeah. And what I say actually when they do that is I say, I don't know why you said that to me because I love you. You know, which is like maybe the most vampiric thing to say to them.
Try to they freak them out. And
You know, so anyway, that's the longest, most meandering answer to your question.
Yeah.
Like that piece is about exploring an archetype.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like and I think over the last 10 years, like 8 or 9 years ago, I would have said like I'd never make a piece about vampires. That's too accessible. That's too. But like, there's a reason why those symbols.
I didn't
and signs
even necessarily see it as a vampire when I was watching it because you don't have like the stereotypical Bela Lugosi get up.
Oh my god! Right? Yeah. Right.
That would just be kind of hokey because that's a whole thing in itself. You know. It's,
right. I really wrestle with that.
Yeah, that would be more referencing like a pop culture thing, and
right,
it would
make
it very strange to.
Well, and that's like a. Thin narrative to me.
Mm-hmm.
Like I'm interested in like the narratives that are so swollen, like you just it's the lightest touch and it explodes and people run away.
Transformation in some of your other works. Like you said, there was another vampire piece,
right?
But
so that was, I mean, that was like another. So these two pieces and are sort of a new strain in my work, the vampire work.
Okay,
I have like a, I have a work I've been doing for 8 years now, sort of around the archetype of the Minotaur.
Yeah, I saw a lot of pieces around that, and I was interested, so we can just jump right in there if you want.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're sort of, so I think when I start doing a piece, and you know, this is always the frustrating thing about talking about performance art on some level, because on the surface it resembles, like, you can use the same vocabulary that you use for theater.
Mm-hmm.
Like, am I playing a character? Actually, no. Right? Like, and so it's hard to talk about why I use these, I would call them sort of like narrative structures.
Mm-hmm.
So the Minotaur, to me, is this, you know, is this like horribly impotent and powerful and sad thing.
Mm.
Right?
I don't remember the, myth of the Minotaur, if you could run it down for me. It lives in the labyrinth below a palace in like Crete. Is that right?
That's totally right. Yeah. I mean,
I got it right.
So the interesting thing about the Minotaur is, and I'll give you like the layman's version, right? So like a lusty, proud queen gets fucked by a god, right? And her husband is, and she gets fucked by Zeus, who's comes to her in the shape of a bull.
Okay.
Right. And this is now I'm all screwed up. So you're gonna have to forgive me on this.
Yeah.
Maybe edit it out.
Yeah, we'll see how it goes. We'll see how this story ends up.
So the main, I've told the story so many times. The main idea of the Minotaur is human folly begets a monstrosity, right?
Okay.
And the monster Minotaur, which is like, and he's created because angry, jealous King Minos. Punishes his wife, right? And the result is the Minotaur, half man, half bull.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing about it, and like every myth teller from like Robert Graves to like the more like oral traditions tells the story in a different way, which is why it's hard to say there's a definitive thing.
Mm-hmm.
So like in my imagination, the Minotaur And there's some versions of the myth that back it up that, like, they tried to keep him at court for a while. Like, they tried to, like, put the Minotaur at a long dining table,
mm-hmm.
and, like, he would fucking eat someone. You know, he'd be like, no, 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 like, he's like the prince, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so it's sort of, I'm like, and King Minos is like, well, like, I can't kill him, because he's technically royal, so I've got to build a structure to contain him, and maybe use him as a weapon, like, weaponize him,
yeah.
right? And so the whole deal is, as fealty to King Minos, they, the surrounding towns would send 7 virgins, you know, as an offering, and the Minotaur would rip them in half and eat them. And then Theseus comes along and tricks his way into the situation and ends up killing the Minotaur.
Mm.
But the myth is actually, like, so my job as an artist, I believe, is to take structures that exist and sort of pollute them.
Mm. I remember reading that you said you like to steal from traditions, religious practice, and collaborators, and get their stories wrong to make them right in another way. And I think
right.
that was an interesting way of stating it, and I wanted to know more about, like...
Well, so, like, I'm
intentionally getting it wrong to make it right, or what that meant exactly to you.
Well, like, so the reason why, like, and I'm a classic lapsed Catholic, like,
mm-hmm.
You know, like, when I was in first grade, nuns would, like, you know, lock me in the closet all day and hit me with rulers and shit, and, like, you know, and I wish I could show it to you. I had this, like, book where every year I would write down what I wanted to be when I grew up. It was this, like, total... It was insane, and I did it. It was so weird. And,
I did that, too, exactly.
In second grade in Catholic school, I said I wanted to be a preacher of God.
Yeah.
And if I dig into this and I really think about it, I believed in that shit so powerfully and so profoundly. And I think once I don't know, maybe hit the age of reason?
Yeah.
Or maybe the first critical theory class I took? I don't know what it was. Like, something...
Once you learn how to question what you're being told.
Like, yeah, well, and when I got confirmed, which I fucking didn't want to be, I told the priest was like, so do you have any sins? Do you have anything you want to tell me? And I was like, yeah, I don't believe in God, man. My mom made me come.
Wow.
And he was like, smack me right across the face, you know? Like, what are you doing here? It's an insult, blah, 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 you know? And... So I think at that point I realized that people were telling these great, these incredible stories to control, right? I mean, that's very oblique, but like...
Yeah. That's essentially what religion is. It's a creation of order through storytelling, and social order,
political order. So the artist is confronted with this, like, really difficult problem where there are stories that exist that have this, like... fucking power. I mean, they're so powerful.
Mm-hmm.
I can't even run away from it. I dream about this shit, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And like, but the aims of those stories are heinous and
yeah.
really terrible, you know?
Even people don't even consider a lot of the time that the old mythology, the Greek and Roman mythology, like, that was religion. Like, people lived by that and thought
yeah.
that was real. That defined
right, and it reinforced, like, the class structures and the socioeconomic structures that existed
yeah.
then, and so, like, my deal is, like, rather than invent something, use the thing that's there, that's potent,
mm-hmm.
that has venom, right, but redirect it so that it serves a sort of... This is so funny. So today my lesson in my class was Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
Mm.
Do you know that?
I know.
So it's just like
vaguely
pocket psychologist. I shouldn't say that, but he's
it's like the need for self fulfillment and actualization and stuff.
Well, that's the absolute, like, highest level
yeah.
need. Like, the bottom is, like, you need food, water, a place to live, and sex,
mm-hmm.
and then the next, and so it goes up and up and up into self actualization. So, like, at the top of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, like, I think my role as an artist is to make people say, wait, I'm familiar with the story, I think I know it,
mm.
but hold on. Like, actually, that story is fucked up. You know, so what I do is, with the Minotaur performance in particular, I use that structure, and I take all the power away from it. I take all the fear away from it.
Mm-hmm.
And I chain myself up to, like, a telephone pole, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And...
This is like a series of several performances, right? Because I saw a lot of different scenes with...
Yeah, I think there's maybe six or seven. Like, I've done it in multiple iterations, and every single iteration has had the same exact effect.
Mm-hmm.
It makes people the worst versions of themselves. It's amazing, actually.
Yeah. So when you're chained to a telephone pole on the sidewalk, like, what happens?
But
just to be clear, like, you're a person sitting there with this, like, minotaur...
Like a blue bull's head on.
Bull's head on, yeah.
And what's interesting, so it's like... So I get them from this, like, mask maker in the UK. Mm. We don't need to go there, but, like, there's an interesting sort of, like, there's an aesthetic conversation that, like, it's, like, it's just enough to suspend disbelief, but it's fake enough to be approachable.
Yeah.
On some level. You know what I mean? It's like a Halloween mask, but I did something to it, and people are like, what the fuck's going on? I don't know.
It crosses that kind of surreal plane of, like, reality and...
Which is really, like, so my job is to, like, it's always about the double blind. Like, you know, I'm fake. This is not for real, but approach. And it all of a sudden it becomes very real, right? So, like, and just for the purpose of our conversation, like, I don't think the art happens until the audience is activated.
Okay.
On some level.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so I did the piece in Washington Square Park. I was invited to do, like, a public art, you know, like, park piece. And so I chained myself to a sort of a famous, like, Hare Krishna tree, this, like, peace tree. This, like, beautiful... I mean, it's a beautiful tree. It's an inspiring tree.
Just out of curiosity, did you, like, ride the subway there with the head on, or did you...
No.
Okay.
No.
The Minotaur...
I really get my ass kicked then, right? Riding all the way from Brooklyn, though. So here we are on the Lower East Side. I was there, I think, for 6 hours, maybe 8 hours. I can't remember how long it was. And a group of teenagers, like skate rats, showed up. And their parents were actually there. So they were sort of like young skate rats.
Mm.
And their parents watched and sort of snickered as the kids beat me with their skateboards. Like, turned them upside down and hit me and yelled at me.
Weird.
Yeah,
they just allowed that, and
well, I don't know. I mean, so then that's like that moment partially was like when the art started happening.
Okay.
Like all of these questions explode from that activity, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's clear that these people have a relationship to these other people, and it's clear that on some level the parents accept in my indigence or my. So it's all about power, right? Like, I'm laying on the ground, and they assume that I've chosen this role. And I mean, there's a lot of assumptions at play.
Yeah.
And like, everyone who's in the environment tacitly approves, right? But because they're complicit in these children, like, beating the shit out of me, right? And to complicate it even further, I had asked 50 collaborators to show up in the park with sort of a like a rated G version of the mask. So, like, a really, like, a Clarabelle cow minotaur mask that was painted purple. So, actually, the beating heart of the piece for me was that the minotaur is dreaming. And all of these people, like, throwing a football in minotaur masks, and families in minotaur masks, and families reading, or people reading the New York Times in minotaur masks.
Mm-hmm.
These are all the things that the minotaur is actually, like, excluded from.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that even goes back to the, like, I think of the minotaur at the dining room table, you know, like, trying to be, like, acculturated or something, you know.
Incredible.
Right. And even so, even though they were, like, even though the people doing the beating were embedded in like, several social structures and several narrative structures, still that, the chaos reigned.
Mm-hmm.
Still, like, it came out. People have broken bottles on me. I did a piece at my old studio, the Gowanus Studio Space, where I was the minotaur in the basement of a factory. Actually, it was the factory that invented and produced Cosby sweaters, which is a tangent.
Wow!
Right, it was amazing. Like, thank you
That's
for
like
existing.
A holy grail of some kind of ironic.
Yeah. So I was like in the basement as the minotaur. Like, in a nest of Cosby sweaters, chained through the ceiling,
Okay.
There's a chain around my ankle, and it went through the ceiling, and it was attached to one of the giant Cosby sweater looms. Right? And I should preface all this by saying that I've never made any money doing any of the work. So I bought like three really fancy surveillance cameras, mm-hmm. and I beamed a projection of the Minotaur downstairs, upstairs to this like art event, right? So okay. the only way that people were allowed to interact,
a
live feed of the Minotaur, mm-hmm. and it was like by all rights, like after talking to people, it was like a compelling image. It was really weird, mm-hmm. and people, you know, tugged on the chain, you know, mm-hmm. through the floor and sort of this, and eventually, a couple of four drunk guys, mm-hmm. somehow subverted the person that I had assigned to watch the door, because this was never intended to be like an interactive piece. This was like, mm-hmm. you know, and I was talking about all issues of surveillance. Like, I mean, there's all sorts of layers going on there. But so these guys broke in,
yeah.
And I've never actually been more scared in my life, quite honestly. I mean, it's a fucking mask, man. Yeah. You know, I can't see shit. And it was this like dark. It's like this horrible dark basement. And so these guys came and they started by taking their beer and sort of like spraying me with it. Mm. And then one of them grabbed a fluorescent, like a 6 foot long fluorescent light bulb and broke it on my body. and I was just like, I mean, at that moment, I was like, this, the art just started to happen. Mm. Like, I have no grandiose art theories. I never went to art school.
Really?
Yeah, but so my theory is, at least with respect to performance, and I think also on some level it applies to sculpture and drawing too, but that if the audience doesn't feel like they're getting their due, they become the artist and they become the performer. Mm-hmm.
Suppose that's why people are attacking you.
Well, they're like,
they don't feel like they're getting what they expect out of it,
or like the story that I expect to be told isn't being told, mm-hmm. so I'm going to become the storyteller.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
like that's my job to become.
Yeah,
I'm just baffled
that people would attack somebody for any reason. Like if I saw someone in a mask, I might sit there and enjoy
this is New York City, baby.
This surreal moment and be like, this is very odd.
I have like another body of work where I've done a lot of like sort of like ritualized cleaning pieces where mm-hmm. I've cleaned people's feet like one-on-one. Mm-hmm. I asked the public to clean 40 people's feet in Union Square. I did the same piece in Macedonia. I was invited to do like a performance festival in Bitola, Macedonia. Mm-hmm. And even there, like I did a ritual feet cleaning piece where I cleaned these people's feet for like 12 hours. They were wearing white cloaks. And I was like berated and I was physically pushed.
Well, that's like where Macedonia in the Middle East is where foot cleaning like started. That's biblical stuff.
Yeah. I mean,
but
there's feet cleaning traditions in almost every major world religion.
Mm. I thought it was distinctly not European, though. But am I wrong?
Well, there's like in Catholicism, there's Maundy Thursday, which is the moment when there's this amazing day when the priest subjugates himself and cleans the feet of the congregation as sort of this like expression of servitude.
Okay.
Right, but there are like
I was unaware of that because I was raised like a kind of generic Christian. But
yeah.
I do remember reading
Protestant.
Reading about a foot cleaning in the Bible. That's the first thing that I think of.
Right, but so and I'm gonna destroy this pronunciation, but in Islam there's the tradition of wudu, right? Mm-hmm. Sort of like the way that you prepare yourself and clean yourself before prayer,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's
And also, like, if you go back to, you know, Christ's time, right?
Mm-hmm.
Washing feet was a way to honor a guest. Mm-hmm. Like, before someone walked into your home, it was a way to show that you respected them and welcomed them into your home.
Mm-hmm.
But more importantly, like, so I've done this piece, like, a lot. You know, I've done this piece in different places, in different contexts, from, like, art galleries to the street, to, like, when I did it in Macedonia, it was in an ancient Turkish open-air market that has now, in modern times, been turned into the one place where every Bitolan pays their utility bill. And when I did the piece, that was payday. Like, every fucking person in the city saw the piece.
Yeah.
And this piece too, or this idea of, like, upending power structures that are typically clear,
mm-hmm.
is really, like, that's when the art happens. That's when the story starts being told.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I've done this piece enough times that, like, for some people, when they have their feet washed, it's like a sexual experience. For some people, it's a macho experience. For some people, people who are used to having their feet serviced, it's another kind of, you know, so it's just mm-hmm. like all of a sudden, by doing this one simple ritual, you're accessing these narratives that are, like, that will mm-hmm. fuck you up forever. You know, like I authentically felt, I have authentically understood what it means to serve,
mm-hmm.
you know, to be a servant. Like, someone was telling me by applying pressure against my hand that I'm lesser than them.
Yeah.
Right. And hopefully by doing the action out of a, like, out of the context of, like, a nail salon,
mm-hmm.
they'll be aware of that too, though I wouldn't say that those people were aware of it. So, I don't know. I mean,
do you find it hard to keep from freaking out on people when they treat you like, I can't stand, like, when somebody, I think unjustifiably, like, treats me as lesser. You know, I was just telling someone the other day, like, you know, if I work in a certain...
Well, fuck you, Matt.
Yeah. It's like I work in a nicer restaurant now as mm-hmm. a cook, and people respect it because of, like, the place that I work and the things I put out. But if I work at a lesser restaurant, which I did before, I get, like, these uneducated, like, white trash people, they're treating me like I'm stupid. And I'm like, I got two college degrees. Like,
right.
You're treating me like I'm an idiot because, like, just because I work here? Like,
I'm in Brooklyn to exit art, so I walked across the Brooklyn Bridge. It was also fucking freezing. I convinced a couple of my, like, chumpy friends to follow me with cameras.
Yeah.
And we walked through Manhattan. It was like a 7-mile walk to exit art, where I had built sort of a structure, like a funerary structure, that had a door on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
And by that I just really mean it was like a string of lights in the shape of a door.
Mm-hmm.
And so I carried the pieces of this door with me.
I remember seeing, wasn't it like there was an entire door on your back? Was that the same?
That's another piece, actually. That's a piece I did.
We can finish this one.
And my idea was to sort of, like, approximate the sky burial ritual, mm-hmm. like as if I were the one making the passage.
Mm-hmm.
And when I showed up at Exit Art, there was a crowd of people, and I sort of, like, bullied my way through them, and I dropped the pieces of my door.
There were all people there to see this.
Yeah. Okay. And sort of, like, and I, you know, and I, like, shy away from saying, like, from ascribing particular narrative meaning to each piece, because I think it's richer if I don't. But, like, on some level, I think I was carrying my own body, or I was carrying my bones.
Mm-hmm. It's the remains of
right, it's something. Like something physical, right? Mm-hmm. And so I dropped the door that I had destroyed on the ground. I took off my clothes. And significantly, I'm sure my wife's going to listen to this, but I took off my wedding ring, too.
Mm-hmm.
So I was, you know, nude as the day I was born,
mm-hmm.
and walked up onto this funerary structure. Now, the one thing that I haven't been able to communicate through the documentation is a friend of mine, a collaborator of mine, designed an algorithmic drone. A drone that, like, and we calibrated the decibels so it was, like, just a little bit less than a jet engine.
Wow.
So it was mm-hmm. this, like,
horrible, horrible, horrible sound. That, and it was really amazing. I mean, he's a genius. This is this guy named Paul Paradiso, who's like an NYU fucking genius. He's whatever. He's working on me on this next project that I'm doing. But the algorithm was designed to produce a bit of random sound and then eat that sound and reconfigure it. So it was this thing that was like feeding on itself, yeah, right? It was
cyclically get louder and crazier.
It didn't get louder or crazier. It just got more complex. Like, it got more aggressive, but not in the way that we're used to. It's not like Metallica, like, getting louder, you know? Yeah. It's like, I don't know. It was this, and it was so loud that people could only be in the room for like 10 minutes at a time, and they had to leave and come back and leave and come back. And like, so I was there.
Like Radiohead did something like that, where they would take crowd sound and sample it and then play it back to the crowd, but then they would record while they were playing that.
People going, no!
Plus the new crowd sound, and then it amplified several times. So. That's just what I was thinking.
But No. So I was there for 4 hours, like, when my ears were fucking bleeding, and I was freezing. Totally unhinged and losing my mind, looking up through this rectangle of light, and I don't know. I mean, I'm like doggedly committed to saying that the work isn't for me and it's not about me. But like that night, on like the night that I turned 30, I passed on. You know, it was very 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 powerful.
I don't think I could do that.
Well, yeah, and well, at the same time, I'm like, you're like a dude on a lawn chair with everyone looking at your dick. At the same time, too. I mean, you know, like, but at that point, I'd gone through so much that that didn't matter. So, like that. I think I have a picture of that if you want to see it.
Sure.
You know, you know, you do a piece like that. Let's see. Sky Burial 1 and 2. So that was sort of the thing, right?
Okay.
So, like, I had... Like, that's the thing. I don't know. And like, I collaborated with Exit Art to build this beautiful structure. I mean, it was, like, actually... And I that's what I said to you earlier when we were walking here, that, like, I think the secret to being a successful artist is working with people who are more talented than you are. You know? Like, I had this idea that I wanted to reinterpret this ritual... And I found people who spoke the same language that I speak, and who were like, I get that. Like, that's important. And they were, like, geniuses who, like, helped me build that thing that, like, I don't know, if you look at it, I'm, like, sort of floating.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's totally... It's
kind of like a platform that keeps the lights suspended above you in a rectangle.
It was totally, like, a transcendent vehicle. You know, and like, and when I talk to people about the piece, they can't even really talk about it. You know, it's just like a thing that happened that there isn't adequate, rhetorical blanket to cover. You know, just like this thing. You know,
yeah.
and like that's one of the important roles of art to confound. You know, to present someone with something that they can't, they don't have the vocabulary and they don't have the power to take it apart easily.
Started a little bit on that piece where you're walking.
I wander, man.
With the entire door on your back. Right. Was that related at all, or
was it related? Yeah, I mean they're all related on some level. I was invited to do a show at the Museum of Modern Art by my mentor, this guy William Popel. He was curating the show at MoMA, and it was a Fluxus show. So I don't know if you know Fluxus, sort of like a 50s, 60s, 70s movement, like most notably championed by Yoko Ono, but like there was like the real proponents of it, like George Mishunis, J. Jeff Hendricks, who was Jeff Hendricks was William Popel's teacher, and William Popel was my teacher. And I'm not saying that there's. I mean, I wish that, that's the way it worked, but I'm not sure that it is. But so I was like really humbled to be part of the show with some of my like some of the people I admire the most in the world. Like fucking Kara Walker did a piece after mine, and it was amazing. So like one of Popel's. I don't want to say that. I'm not sure that's true. I was gonna, so like one of the big ideas in my work is the idea this idea of void, and I keep coming back to void.
Yeah,
and it's a big Yves Klein idea. Like he's like he was sort of obsessed with the philosophical idea of void, and like I'm chased by like him jumping out of the window, wishing I had done that, and you know, and so I did two pieces at MoMA. One was called Be Void, and one was called Void Door. Be Void, I sang a beautiful song with a little bit of an accompaniment from my friends. It was, I always feel like I'm giving up the ghost by telling all this stuff, but it was a song by Joan Baez's sister. And one of but written and performed by one of Thomas Pynchon's like best friends.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
So like, so I had this sort of like in my pocket. I was like, I'm like getting Pynchon in there, you know? It's fucked up. And so what I did is I sang this like, and Pynchon's friend's name is Richard Farina, to whom Gravity's Rainbow is actually dedicated.
Okay.
And he was this sort of like folk hero, and he was like one of the only guys that played this like. Crazy beautiful Appalachian instrument, and he married Mimi Baez, who was like this beautiful girl in the world, and they sort of like lived this like weird folk life, and I sang this Richard Farina Mimi Baez song to a coyote, to that same coyote pelt that you saw, asking the coyote ostensibly for forgiveness.
Okay.
So I bought the coyote from this guy in Montana through eBay. It was $9 for the coyote pelt. He shot it in his backyard. And when I took it out of the FedEx box, it still smelled like Marlboro Reds.
Yeah.
and on his eBay page...
That creates such a vivid portrait of that guy. Like,
totally. Well, and I'm so not making this shit up. Like, this is so fucking real. And I found the coyote. I'm trying to find the... yeah, here it is. And I found it on eBay because there was a woman wearing, and I'm not lying, a red, white, and blue Stars and Stripes bikini. And the coyote was like, it was like his wife. Like, and she was holding a fucking gun. It was so insane. So for $9, I got this beautiful coyote.
You should have that picture on your wall somewhere. Like,
right, right, yeah.
I should have the picture on my wall.
So I sang... the song to the coyote asking for its forgiveness, because the coyote, of course I say, is the only like sort of spirit that can cross between the land of the living and the land of the dead.
Okay.
In Native American mythology, and actually several mythologies, right?
Mm-hmm.
So part of this was like I was singing this song by someone who had already on some level touched the void.
Mm-hmm.
Asking the coyote to ferry me to the void. Because right? That's my job as a storyteller, is to like bring the audience closer to the void. So I sang the song until I passed out.
Wow.
How long was
that?
Not as long as you would think. I don't know if the last time you've sung something as loud as you can for as long as you can. Also, I have.
I don't really know how to go above this volume.
Uh-huh.
And I've already said, like, 10 times as many words as I do in a normal day. Yeah, right.
So the second part, that was Be Void, sort of singing to the coyote and asking for forgiveness. And there's an obvious nod to Boys. Like, Boys did the piece where he lived in a space with the coyote for a while. So I'm, like, trying to... I mean, then that show was also part of, like, doing homage to your... to where you come from. Right, like my mentor brought me to the show, so I wanted to. And on my 21st fucking birthday, William Popel gave me Joseph Boy's writings. So, and like, he literally inscribed it on your 21st birthday. Like, yeah. Like the most important book I've ever owned.
Yeah.
Like, given to me by my teacher, right?
Oh, so, no, like, man.
Right? I mean, it was like, whatever, man. You know? And so the second piece was called Void Door.
Mm-hmm.
And I carried a door on my back from Coney Island. I like stood in the water in Coney Island and I walked it to the Museum of Modern Art.
Okay.
So it was a long walk.
It's like half the distance the Warriors covered in the, yeah. The Warriors.
And I actually had like a guy, a lovely guy, another artist named Amory Kessler, who walked the whole way with me, which was really amazing. Because yeah, it wasn't. So I will admit that it wasn't like a solid oak door. It was like a shitty Lowe's.
Okay,
it was like a particle board door. It wasn't hollow core, but it was particle board. So it was, and I had like a crazy like. I mean, it was very, 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 very difficult physically. Mm-hmm. However,
I mean, if it's breezy out on the bridge, you're going to be getting blown around with
that. Well, and then again, like to talk about the way that the work affects the public, like, you know, I mean, I think the door was knocked on like 100 times, yeah. Mostly by like European tourists, actually. Yeah. So I got the store all the way to MoMA, and part of that in my practice anyway is like taking this object and charging it up,
mm-hmm.
right? So like giving it the energy that the journey's charging up. So I got there, and I had like 10 minutes to do a performance. This is very odd for me too. Like, and I would only really do it for Popo, but he's like, you have 10 minutes on a stage in MoMA. What the fuck are you going to do, right? So I, like, look out at the audience and, like, I see fucking Marina Abramović, like, in the sixth row or something, you know? And it's, like, on some level, like, the greatest and most incredible moment of my life. And I'm interested in doors.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm interested in the idea of
an
doors.
An entryway into another space, such as the void.
Right. And so this whole time that I was walking, I knew that I was going to grab my wife from the audience. She didn't know this, actually. But on my way down, I mean, and I was delirious. I was like, I was a nutcase. I'd been walking for like 10 hours.
Yeah, that's a full day commitment.
Yeah.
Just to ride the subway down to Coney Island.
Right, yeah, right. And so I grabbed her on my way down the aisle. And she looked at me like, you motherfucker. But on some level, too, I was like, I'm doing a piece at MoMA. Like, I'm going to get my wife up. And I painted the door. I, sort of just opened it up. Like, I think the paint... And that's, like, sort of the art moment, too. Like, I felt like I needed to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And also, like, dignify that that notion that, like, painting is art on some level.
Mm-hmm.
And MoMA had bought me a Tibetan Dorje bell from Tibet.
Yeah.
They had it mailed from Tibet.
Nice. That's the perks of showing at MoMA.
Fucking shit, man. And so I held the door at a 45 degree angle over my wife's head and precariously rang the bell and opened the void for her.
Okay.
And sort of like allowed her to look through it, and then we switched, and I lay under the door and rang the bell, and I think, isn't that what we do?
Open the void for each other.
Well, like, I'm a fucked up person. I mean, you know, like we all are in different ways, but like, you know, I taste the void in my mouth every day.
Yeah.
I mean, that's who I am. You know what I mean? And I'm like scared to be alive. I am. It's like hard to be alive. I mean, and it's easier for some people, but it's hard for me. And like on some level, and what was interesting actually, the feedback that I got from the piece was that they knew that we had a relationship, but that they weren't clear about what the relationship was, but that there was this like the word that I took away from it is there was like a willingness, right? Mm-hmm. That's actually like a really potent idea, is that like in a marriage or in a partnership, really the most powerful thing that you have is willingness,
mm-hmm.
to see things differently, to hold things you wouldn't normally hold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you gotta kind of give something of yourself, your own stance up to be with somebody else, because nobody's gonna be just like you.
God, I hope not.
Yeah, and if you did meet someone just like you,
weird, right? I'd be in like a fucking.
That wouldn't necessarily make for a good relationship if you were just like somebody else.
But I trust you enough to hold the goddamn void over my head.
Yeah.
And not to let me fall in.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, like, the horrible cliche... this is the thing that I really avoid, but, you know...
It
people,
would be cliche if it wasn't...
The people have asked me over the years doing these pieces. It's like, what, you know, like, why are you making art? Why are you doing this? Why are you doing this? And actually, like, the only thing that makes us special and stupid as a species is that we love... I think that's like incredibly foolish and ridiculous. Right?
Yeah.
But we can't seem to help it. Like, this is what we do, actually.
Mm. Yeah, I read a book by Will Self. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but...
My Idea of Fun?
Yes. That is his work. But have you read Great Apes? That's the crux of that story is...
A great... Like, he's like the Jonathan Swift of the 20th century, man.
Is like the only thing that separates also, us from being
a former heroin addict. He's fucking interesting. He's so amazing.
I don't think I could handle talking to him because he would just blow me away with intelligence. I'm like, I can't like, keep up with
but,
you.
Yeah, but like talking about like ritual and talking about like figuring your life out. Here's a guy who's like blowing heroin on Tony Blair's private plane and like following the press junket, and like he straightened himself up, he cleaned himself up, and he cleaned himself up by walking.
Yeah, I just read Walking to New York, or
the New York Times piece where he got off the plane at
LaGuardia.
He walks
to the airport.
I can't believe you brought that up. Like that, like that's why I walk partially is Will Self.
Mm. He was talking about trying to rectify his past and
like
his
that motherfucker fucked me up. You know, for real.
He's a head trip, like definitely. Like,
and
story you read by him.
In my idea, did you read My Idea Fund?
Uh huh.
Do you know that the Fat Controller is Sir Topham Hatt in Thomas the Tank Engine?
I did not know that.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
I've,
so Thomas the Tank Engine is this like
the tank engine is,
and but. So the boss like the and he looks like the guy in Monopoly like the
yeah the
guy
top hat and the
and like in the original stories by Reverend Audrey, right, the guy who invented Thomas the Tank Engine, he was called the Fat Controller, not called Sir Topham Hatt.
Yeah,
and I and like when I saw that I was like,
he does draw on those like kind of oblique pop culture references though. If you read Tough, Tough Toys for Tough, Tough Boys.
No.
He references the Tonka. It was like a Tonka advertising
type.
So he's really clever at like picking those things out and placing them in this like
and
really
so, like,
disturbing wrong.
Yeah, man. I mean, so like Will scenario. Self changed my life. David Foster Wallace like destroyed me. Like my wife and I fell in love reading Infinite Jest.
Yeah.
But that's how we found each other. Because
yeah.
We read that book together, and we were like, we better stick together.
As part of a book group, or just...
No, just at the same time. I mean, we were, like, best friends, and we were like, maybe we should read a book together. And, like, by the end, we were like, bom, tick, bom, bom. Like, this is like, if we can get through this together, this is
you can tear down mountains.
Totally.
I've never read it, but...
You haven't read it?
Oh, I have not gotten to that one.
Come on, man!
I got a stack of... dozens of books I haven't read yet.
Put them all, knock them all aside. Stop reading Game of Thrones and read fucking Infinite Jest, man.
I barely know what a throne game is. The only reason I know it exists is because they advertised during NCAA basketball. You mentioned Thomas Pynchon earlier.
Yeah.
I have, like, three... I have Gravity's Rainbow, I have Vineland, I have V. I have yet to get through them because it's so hard to find the time commitment to stick with it. It's not...
Right.
You can't digest it in small doses like I can
right.
a Vonnegut, or even Will Self a little bit you can do that with.
But right.
if you're going to read Pynchon, you got to read 50 pages at a time, otherwise you're going to forget what's happening.
Right, and or right, yeah. I mean, it's all about, like, Pynchon's all about, like, schema.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you need to, like, sort of dial into a schema and be like...
Yeah. And that's how I see David Foster Wallace, too, is...
He's different, though.
You really need to, like...
No, I disagree.
...get it for a little bit. Especially a book that's that long.
But he... like, Wallace is, like, a fucking romantic.
Yeah.
Like, well, and Wallace is, like, in my heart as an artist in many ways. Like, so in one of the times that he was interviewed... and asked about Infinite Jest, for instance, he said, "The reason why I wrote this book is because I wanted to make something really long and really sad." And I was like, "Me too.
Yeah,
that's what I do. That's what I want to do. That's me. I want to do that." You know, and that was part of my impetus for like the next big project I'm working on is I'm actually doing like I'm making a game. I'm making a video game.
Okay.
Next. And I'm taking so here's the pitch. Do you want to hear it?
Sure.
I'm going to try to sound like really fancy and advertising.
Don't try to get any money out of me. I'll got it.
Yeah. No, we haven't started our Kickstarter campaign. Come to you later. Only $10. That's all. You've got $10. So the world ends.
Mm-hmm.
And 75 years after the world ends, the Minotaur wakes up in a basement. He rips free from his chains.
Mm-hmm.
And as the user, you navigate the blasted world as the Minotaur. So it's sort of like a Beckett play as a video game, right?
Is there an objective or a goal?
You can't win.
You can't win.
and literally, the landscape of the game is the map of the world. Right,
okay.
So in real time, you can walk from New York to L.A.
You're going to construct a map that's that big that it would
right. We're
real
like,
time.
Represent. Yeah, I mean, I just had like a 5-hour meeting last night about this. Like, so
how would that work though? Like, that's so much data that would.
Right. So I'm not going to tell you all the secrets.
Okay.
and it is like immediately your brain starts saying like, how would they do that? I don't know. But the most interesting thing about the game, however, is that we're going to use all of the photographs that are tagged through Flickr and Facebook and populate the game with what I'm calling nodes.
Okay.
Right? So, for instance, like, I took my family this summer to Cape Cod, which was awesome.
Mm.
And I'd never been there, and it was beautiful. And as I was there, I was thinking, like, how many photographs were taken and tagged on this beach, right? So you're the Minotaur. There's a submarine sticking out of the fucking water, right? And there's like, like all of the corpses, like from Massachusetts that came around, you know, banging against the beach, and you see this like brilliant cloud, right? And as the Minotaur, as the user, you can walk into this cloud, and the cloud is sort of the aggregate of all these tagged images.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of this like portal into the collective memory of humankind.
Mm-hmm.
So like I'm trying to like take our narrative, the narrative that we've like elected to make public, the narrative that we've elected to share, and using it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like against the backdrop of absolute Armageddon and apocalypse, which is coming.
Yeah.
Not to be that kind of fucking guy, but like, I mean, you know,
you could get me on that train if you wanted to,
right? and I it's like sort of de rigueur for me as an artist. Like, I think I have to say the apocalypse is coming, right? But I'm interested in taking like our stories and placing them in another context and making people reconsider, right? And we're also building functionality into the game where it's like, Like, if you have an object, if you have, like, a locket or a keepsake from a lover, you can actually maybe take a picture of it, right, and like, upload it into the future world, right? And we're going to work with other artists to curate. So there's this one guy who's so amazing. There's this guy, Robert Peer, who's this... he's a video artist, and he takes these, like destroyed landscapes, and he just does this, like, really spare language across destroyed landscapes. And so I had a meeting with him, and he's like, I would love to take pictures and create, like, this... Like, I mean, it's sort of like a hashtag structure. Like, so you can take pictures in this project called... The project's called End of Empire.
Okay.
Right. And Robert, he's like, well, what if I took pictures inside of a seedy motel right outside of the Holland Tunnel, like the place where everyone fucks hookers and like congressmen do coke and like, you know, this whole thing. So he's like, I can create this like house of horrors, right? Mm-hmm. And the user can like go into this situation and sort of experience it, you know, like have like a little like The Shining moment, yeah, you know, where there's like the guy in the bear suit going like, and so like this project is a way to like, you know, is a way, I think, to try to, like, open... See, my problem is I've been making performances and I've been making art for people for the last 10 years. And the audience is almost always the same, unless it's a public project.
Uh-huh.
You're sort of like making work for the acolytes. Like, there are people... I mean, there's incredible artists in New York City, and there's incredible people in New York City, and there are incredible people who are, like, looking at performance as a medium. But it's not like a celebrated and accepted medium.
Yeah. That's so, kind of what I'm writing about in the write up of the performance that I saw you in, is how performance always, it's been around for decades now as an accepted form of making art, but it's always...
We could argue about that all night.
It's always going to be on the fringe. Like, it's always going to be, it doesn't seem like it's going to ever be...
Well, you can't buy it or sell it. That's the fucking problem.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, that's like the long short of it, but I'm not even interested necessarily in talking about that, but like, I've had to sort of like, I did like do like a personal inventory after years of sort of like being part of like the New York openings scene and like doing galleries and doing this whole thing and like saying like, you know what? I'm not an artist. Like, I'm a storyteller.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I do. And like, an important part of being a storyteller is having an audience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, and David Foster Wallace saying, like, I want to make like an incredibly long and an incredibly sad story. I realized I need to do the same thing. Mm-hmm. And so so one day on my way to teach at public school, I was on the R train, like getting like planning a lesson in my head. And there was this, like, weird little kid, like, a weird teenager that... And this is, like, a real New York City moment, but, like, I didn't read the signs, but I sat down, and, like, everyone was sort of getting up and going to the opposite sides of the train, so I was like, oh, fuck. And I had already been sitting down, and so this kid was, like, really freaking out. He was sort of, like... he was, like, sort of, like, bobbing back and forth, and he was in this, like, really aggressive conversation with himself, and he was saying, well... She's not real, but she's very beautiful, and I think even though she's a video game character, she has a soul. and I was like getting hit by a sledgehammer. Like, yeah. I was like, holy shit! There's like a whole generation of kids who accept virtual reality as reality.
Yeah.
And that, like, if I'm going to tell a story, and these are the people I'm going to tell the story to, like, I have to tell it in terms that they'll understand. Yeah. And it's not making a fucking performance in a fucking art gallery in Bushwick, which is awesome to do, and I'm going to keep doing that.
Yeah.
But I was like, you know what? I need to, like...
Yeah, that ties in directly. Like, I was thinking when you were describing the video game idea earlier is a... Sounds like Second Life, you know, kind of creating...
I have a Second Life account. It's so weird. Let's talk about it.
I've never gotten into it. What I know is that select and certain people get really far into it and spend a lot of time on there. And actually saw...
It's like a sex world. You know that.
Yeah, I watched this movie. What was it called? I think it's called When Strangers Click.
Uh-huh.
And it's about romance in the online world. And the final... They tell like four or five stories. The final story they tell...
It's a documentary?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Is this guy in like this remote island of Scandinavia somewhere. He's like out in a fishing shack in the middle of nowhere.
I like him already.
And he's got he's got aspirations to be a musician, but he had to move out there to like take care of his mom or something. But that's when he discovers Second Life, and he describes finding it, and he's like, I didn't know exactly what it was. I thought it was like a video game or something. I was just bored and looking for something to do online.
I mean, it's totally insane.
And then he like builds
It's really boring, actually.
He builds this persona for himself and describes like how he starts a business on Second Life where it's like a rock club, and like he performs there on set nights, and he meets this woman who he falls in love with through never meeting her. She lives in Missouri, actually. And they like go on dates and things and spend time together on Second Life.
In Second Life.
And then he eventually like goes and meets her in real life, and within like the 2 weeks he's there, gets her pregnant, and then has to leave because he's on a tourist visa. And so this couple who had an extensive relationship online created a child, and then they live on opposite ends of the... They're still like together on Second Life, but he doesn't have a means of being there in the real life.
So, I love that you just said that they're still together on Second Life.
Oh, they are, yeah. Like, yeah. And I think he's like working on trying to...
Actualize?
Make it real life. But well, so, it is this like mind-boggling...
Like my Second Life experience is that I mean, I've done insane research for this project. Like, I've done, you know, whatever. I've tried everything. Like a little bit of everything. Like a little bit of Minecraft, a little bit of Second Life, a little bit of Walking Dead, a little bit of everything. Like all the cool ass games out there. And Second Life, I designed a character. I spent, I think, $75 to get like the premium membership or something. And like, I have no idea what I'm doing. So I like outfitted my guy, and I should have known better, but with a paddle. So like, not really understand, you know, thinking like, oh, that's cool, like whatever, haha. Yeah. And so every environment that I went into, I was like heckled. Like, insanely. Like, people said things that were so hurtful that I actually felt like I was in high school again. Like, really fucking, like, look at that bitch noob. Da-da-da. Like, this whole, and it's like this whole vocabulary that's, like, so complex. And so I was like, should I respond? And I'm by myself. Like, my wife's asleep upstairs. And I'm like, is this wrong? Am I, like, breaking some rules here, man? Like, what the fuck is going on? But like, right there, I was in the shit, you know. Like, I was like, I mean, that's like material for art, you know. Like, that world is kind of real. I was just talking to my collaborators last night. There was this this website. Did you ever hear of hell.com?
No.
It was, I think it's an art project, but it was like, I said to my collaborators last night, I was like, What are the times in your life where like the internet has been like genuinely threatening, like where it's like infected you? And hell.com is one of those for me, like where like I think it purported to be like a portal to hell,
okay,
like on some level, but like and my memory's really vague. I think I was like 19, and this is like you and I remember when there wasn't email.
Yeah, definitely.
Like we're a special generation. Like,
email was a novelty in high school.
Totally. And it was like all ASCII and like weird and like and hell.com had that sort of like ASCII, like there was this like pollution involved in it. You sort of like clicked it and you're like, is my computer gonna blow up? Is this whatever? And it had this like sort of sense of danger. And that's what I want to do with my interactive project. Like I wanna create like, I want my mom, who lives in Arizona, to be able to, like, go to endofempire.com and not know what to expect and, like, experience the artifice. Like, experience the top-level story in order to get to the second-level story in order to learn about herself. That's my job. Right? Like, that's the job of the storyteller. That's the job of the shaman, right? And I am not that. Like, I'm... Like, you know, like a little bit of me dies every time I say, like, the shaman, but.
Yeah. It makes me forgive think me. Of the Jim Morrison Doors Odyssey oh, of no. being a shaman, but that's just a. That's an idiom of American culture, is.
Sure.
Trying to seek out that past role. And I've even thought about it in terms of, like, you know, if I were alive, like, several hundred years ago in this native culture, what role would I play? I would probably be the right. shaman, because, like, I don't know, I could also be the cook, too. I do that now.
And right, that's, right, that's right, 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 right. Role, yeah, me too. But, I do all the cooking in my house.
Yeah. But as far as being an artist, like, the artist would be the shaman, because their arts were mostly craftsmen. They were,
which is why, like, one, and so, like, so a lot, a huge part of my practice right now is enacted. I mean, so I do a performance like every 2 months or something, and I'm always making drawings and I'm always making sculptures. But a huge part of my practice now is rooted in Twitter. Mm-hmm. So I'm always writing on Twitter, and like, I have like a very specific set of guidelines that I keep for myself about how I. How I'm building worlds on Twitter,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's really, it's like, I mean, it's so deep and it's like so fascinating.
Yeah, it's endless. You can go forever on Twitter or any.
Yeah, but there, but yeah, but there are like limits. Like, which is really interesting about Twitter is that they're that like as I understand it, the same rules for community building exist in Twitter as with anything else.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, local communities tend to glom together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so, like, I'm sort of tapped, and I sort of, like, tapped into this, like, artist, like, sort of New York artist community. And so much of the dialogue is about art and its value. And, like, what does it mean that this artist did this today? Or, here is a recent attack on a particular value
mm-hmm.
that we have ascribed unto art and storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
I see my role on Twitter as, like, a storyteller. I mean, and this is sort of, I'm trying to connect it to this idea of, like, shaman or something, but, like, mm-hmm. you know, is I've started recently to, like, go like 3 or 4 levels in and find a Twitterer of a Twitterer of a Twitterer of a Twitterer and like send something direct to them
mm-hmm.
that's like sort of threatening and vague. You know what I mean? So like it feels like
they just pick out like Buddy Boy 125 and you're like, hey, fuck you.
No, yeah. I mean, well, it's never like that. It's more like. Like I'm living in this world now, and this is so insane to say because I have two beautiful children, that like I'm killing everyone every day in my head. You know what I mean? Like I'm sort of like living, and this is part of the interactive process, part of my work, is like I'm giving myself over to this idea that I'm like sort of an agent of chaos, and like in Twitter I'm sending, you know, people messages about wraiths. And vampires and you know, like sacks of things.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know what I mean? Like or like black pollination.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, and I've been thinking a lot about wasps. You know, like yeah. What are the most horrifying things? But what are the things? And you know, it's interesting for the interactive project. I've been talking to friends who are like biologists, and I'm like, so if we were all dead, what would take over? And they're like, wasps, definitely wasps.
Wow.
Like, really? Why? And they're like, well, it's a hive mind. It's da-da-da-da, you know, and like that's like a powerful narrative thread to follow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because like as a society and as a culture and a civilization, it's like the individual is king. Like, what you think really matters. Fuck you. No, it doesn't. You know what I mean?
Made me laugh right when you said it.
and I think it's interesting to present, like, as the storyteller, to present that reality or present that construction that's like you're one of many.
Mm-hmm.
You're nothing.
Yeah.
You know, you're like, you're just a hexagonal tunnel.
Yeah.
Sure. You know, like the biggest misdirection, and I say this almost more as a teacher than as an artist, is that we've created a culture where, like, everyone thinks they're a unique and special snowflake.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, and I think it's interesting. I think it's threatening, too, you know, to think about, like, what are you entitled to? Like, what are you entitled to as an American? Because when I was in Macedonia, like, I met people who, you know, like, people who, by our reckoning, are, like, poor, impoverished, who show up at a party with a case of beer. Because that's what they fucking do. You know, like, and I really, I shy away from this, and I'm terrified of it, but, like, the idea that I'm, like, an American artist is important. And I don't talk about it a lot, but, like, my thesis in college was, I wrote, like, an 80-page poem called I Like America and America Likes Me. You know, like, I mean, I think that, you know, the deal is, like, understanding the mythology that you come from and then polluting it and then fucking it up, you know, because, like, what's holy? Nothing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, and whoever tells you that something's holy, they're fucking lying, man. No. They're protecting themselves.
No. Well, I gotta tell you, we have shattered the record on the longest interview I've done.
Oh, how long have we been talking?
Hour and 15 minutes, and we could keep going for another hour and 15 minutes.
Easily. Easily. Is your computer going to die?
No.
I'm just giving you a harder editing challenge.
I think we could stop it here, and
yeah,
maybe it could be a part two, or you never know.
Like, sure,
I'll
man.
Be back in New York, and
yeah.
I'd love to continue talking to you. I think we're in the void right now, and we're just about to exit when I stop this. It's been great.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Fair enough.
It's been great, and I probably will want to talk to you again about some stuff. So maybe totally. We'll see you in the future.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks, man.
Yeah.
That concludes this episode of Studio Sessions with our guest Rob Andrews. You can find his work online at andrewsautomatic.com. You can also learn more about me at my website, mattkuhlman.com. If you'd like to support this program, you can send a donation through PayPal to studiosessionspodcast@gmail.com. Even if you only send $1, your donation helps guarantee I can continue providing interviews with interesting artists for your listening pleasure. And of course, don't forget to visit bigredandshiny.com for future episodes, along with other high-quality arts and culture content. Thank you for listening, and see you next time on Studio Sessions.